Good morning, everybody. Are we awake? It's about 2:31, and it is July 15th. We're going to finish up peripheral nervous system today, move into autonomic nervous system. And most people are really excited when they get into autonomic nervous system because the autonomic nervous system controls almost everything in your body for you. Right? There's only one other part of the nervous system that you have direct control of, and that is skeletal muscle with the somatic nervous system. Okay, so we're going to get into that. But first, we're going to finish up peripheral nervous system. We were right to cranial nerves. All right, so here are cranial nerves right there. Oh, you know what? Let's take a look at the schedule. I got the schedule pulled up on the right-hand side. And we said today's the 15th. Yep, we're going to get into ANS. And tomorrow, special senses, then Monday, endocrine system, and then, less than a week away, is exam number 3. And chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. Make sure you pay attention to the study guides as to what you should be focusing on in those chapters. Right? I mean, it's really great if you study everything in those chapters and really nail it down. For sure, pay attention to those study guides. All right, then after the test, we're going to start with heart. And that's going to be our last segment of the class leading to the last exam on Tuesday, August 5th. That's a strange day. It doesn't end on a Thursday. Okay, so let's see, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Ah, that's not Tuesday. That should be Wednesday. Wednesday, August 5th. So I don't know, you might want to, I can't change it. Okay, Wednesday, August 5th. So, and then in lab, let's see, when do you have a practicum? You got a practicum 1 week from today. No, 1 week from yesterday, third practicum. And we'll go over what you have to know for that. But basically, you know, it's a lab manual. Lab manual is the answer key to the practicum. Okay, does anybody have any questions regarding what we went over, what we should be going over, any of that kind of stuff? I don't see any questions. Okay, so let's finish up cranial nerves. And the chapter that we're in, who knows what chapter we're studying right now? What's the title of the chapter that we're looking at right now? Right now, what are we looking at? What are we talking about? Okay, I want you guys to kind of plug in and focus on what we're looking at, and that is the nervous system. What part of the nervous system? The peripheral nervous system, that's right. And generally, what is that peripheral nervous system? How would you describe to somebody what the peripheral nervous system is? Just by structure, don't think about function, just by structure. Where is it located? Where is it located? It's a little strange because it's a lot easier to say where it's located by saying where it's not located, all right? So it's not located in the central nervous system, right? So it's all the nervous tissue that is outside the brain and spinal cord, right? So outside brain and spinal cord is the peripheral nervous system, including receptors, right? And the effector neurons. And you should know some differences in the neuroglia cells as well between CNS and PNS. Okay, and if we think of all the nerves in the peripheral nervous system, we can break them down into two main categories. Where, and this again is just by anatomy, where are the two locations where we can find peripheral nerves? How do we like to break it down into two categories? First, we want to think of nerves that leave the brain, and those nerves are called cranial nerves. And you have 12 pairs of cranial nerves. Those are hugely important. Well, every nerve in your body is hugely important. I wouldn't want to get rid of any of them. Okay, and then there are nerves that leave the spinal cord. And those that leave the spinal cord are called spinal nerves. So you got cranial nerves and spinal nerves. And we're going to pretty much finish up by talking about cranial nerves. We said that there are 12 pairs. And fortunately, they are numbered, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to 12. They're numbered by their location as you look at the ventral side of the brain. And what side of the brain do I have the cursor on right now? Would you say anterior or posterior? You know enough about neuroanatomy yet to be able to tell me if that's anterior or posterior, where I have the cursor kind of flittering around? That is anterior, right? So down over here, think of this as posterior, but it's also a little inferior, but here's posterior. All right, so the most anterior nerves that I see here and here, right, that's number one. So we start counting from anterior to posterior. So number one, number two, number three, number four. So it's really easy to know the numbers when you have this diagram, okay? So this is an exam figure, and if I ask you to name this nerve right here, you could say number two, right? It's really easy to tell. All right, so you just count down. And the other thing that you have to know is not just the number, but also the name of that particular nerve. All right, so if, for instance, this is cranial nerve number one, most anterior. What's the most anterior sense that you have on your face or your whole body? It is smell, the sense of smell, right? If you walk into a window or a door by accident, your nose gets bashed in first, all right? So think of that as cranial nerve number one. The name for smell is olfaction, so this is the olfactory nerve, right? And then after you smash your nose up against the wall, what other organ gets smashed up against the door? Your eye, right? And so number two is going to be the optic nerve. So a lot of this stuff makes really perfect sense. But it seems a little complicated. So sometimes in anatomy or chemistry or even a biology class, it is good to come up with a little trick to help you memorize a list of words that probably don't make a whole lot of sense by themselves, right? So this will help you remember the order. All right, so here we have the number. And again, how many cranial nerves are there? Can you read Roman numerals? There are, go ahead, say it. You guys got to wake up. Yeah, there are 12. 12 cranial nerves, right? So 1, 2, 3, from anterior to posterior. That's a pretty good way to visualize it. Then here is the name. You got olfactory, which is smell, optic, vision, oculomotor, moves your eyeballs around, right? Abducens, that moves your eyeballs around. It abducts the eye. You know what abduction is? So which way is your eye going to move when it abducts? Is it going to move to midline or is it going to move away from midline? Are you going to look to the side or look to the middle when the abducens tells eye muscles to do something? What is adduction? Adduction is bringing together, bringing something toward midline. Abduction is moving something away from midline, right? So the abducens is a special nerve that moves an eyeball laterally. It rotates a lateral rotation. But you shouldn't do that with both eyes, right? You shouldn't abduct and adduct with both eyes, because what did your mother tell you about doing that? Like making a face with crossed eyes like that, with adducting both eyeballs. Yeah, don't do that because they might get stuck that way, all right? But of course, that's not true. But anyway, I don't know why they tell you that, okay? But abducens is for lateral rotation. Vestibulocochlear, that's for hearing and balance. One of the most important cranial nerves that we're going to look at is the vagus nerve. What number is the vagus nerve? Vagus is number 10, right? So how are you going to remember this funny list of names that maybe you don't even know what olfaction is, right? Well, we like to make a mnemonic. And a mnemonic is a sentence, and the first letter of every word in that sentence corresponds to the first letter of this list of cranial nerves. Or it could be any kind of list that you need to memorize. Like maybe periodic table you can find, all kinds of different mnemonics. So here is the mnemonic to know the order of the names of cranial nerves. And this mnemonic says, this is my favorite one, right? On old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. All right, so the O and on stands for olfactory, the O and old stands for optic, Olympus's, the O and Olympus's stands for oculomotor, towering is trochlear, top trigeminal, and on down the line. A stands for abducens, F for facial, A for vestibulocochlear, right, all down the line, and view, right, V vagus, A accessory, and H hypoglossal. There's only one H, so that's pretty easy to remember, and that's the last word in here. Anybody have any questions on that? How you would use a mnemonic to memorize a list of words? No questions? Okay. usually I get a couple of questions on here because some students might say, well, how does vestibulocochlear refer to this A right here? Okay? And, because V and A are different. Why is that? Maybe you've noticed that. And that's because the original name for cranial nerve number 8 was the auditory nerve, which is used for, what would you use the auditory nerve for? Or cranial nerve 8? What's that responsible for? For? Maybe you guys, come on, you're going to make me fall asleep. It's for hearing, right? It's for hearing. So how does hearing or auditory nerve get transcribed into vestibulocochlear? Well, we're going to see when we get into the sensory chapter that when they change the name of the nerve from auditory to vestibular cochlear, they actually simplified the word, believe it or not. Vestibulocochlear has to do with all of the senses in the ear. The cochlear part is for hearing. The vestibulo part is for equilibrium. So when we get into that chapter, the ear has important sensory apparatus for both equilibrium and hearing. So it's not just the auditory nerve that's important going to that area. All right, your book has a different mnemonic, maybe two other different mnemonics. There's a website called medicalmnemonics.com. You can go and you can search for all kinds of different mnemonics, and you can even filter these mnemonics by how nasty they are, right? They have X-rated mnemonics and all that kind of stuff. And I wish that you don't use any X-rated mnemonics in this class when you go to medicalmnemonics.com, okay? You all agree with that? Okay, anybody dissent with that instruction? That's really good. All right, but probably the best thing to do is to make your own mnemonic, because then you'll have a better chance of memorizing it, right? So you can make your own mnemonic. You could use this one right here or the one in your book. All right, so this is an exam figure. Make sure you can number these things, but also in your knowledge base, you should know what the, not only the number, but the name. And here is a function of these particular nerves, and you should know some of these functions. Let me see if I can get, I don't know what's happening here. Vision, let's get vision back in line. Okay, that's about as much as I can get it to go. Okay, vision. All right, oh, nice. So vision is what? Number 2. Smell is number 1. Oculomotor, pupil constriction. Now, your book might give you 10 or 20 different functions of a particular nerve, but I've simplified that list to where you only have to know one. All right, and as we finish the class, you'll probably just automatically learn a number of other important functions for these nerves, but this is a good place to start. So for facial, what kind of function does the facial nerve perform for us? Facial. Facial's number 7. Taste. Yeah. Hearing and balance is 8. Vestibulocochlear. Motor to the tongue is hypoglossal. Anytime you hear that term glossal, you should just think of tongue, right? That's where that comes from. Vagus. Oh, I told you that was the biggest, probably most important one that we're going to deal with from here on out in the class. So the vagus nerve has an effect on an important organ in your body, and that is the heart, right? And it says, what does it do to the heart? It changes the activity of the heart. How does it change it? It slows the heart rate down, right? And that's important. So do you think it's a really good idea for you to have precise control and balance of your heart rate? Is that an important organ for you? Should it adjust to your activity levels? Would it be a good idea? Yeah, it's a really important organ. So here is a nerve, all right, the vagus nerve, which decreases heart rate, and that should then conjure up in your mind, well, you know what? There is probably a nerve that is what? What's the relationship to this other nerve that you think that should go to the heart? It's not on this list. We're going to look at it in the next chapter. There should also be a nerve, not only that slows the heart down, but a different nerve that speeds the heart up because of that antagonistic principle, right? So that's how precise control and balance is maintained over your heart rate. And the vagus is part of that control mechanism because it slows the heart rate down. And indeed, if the vagus nerve is stimulated by manipulation with a surgery, for instance, or other kinds of manipulations that are kind of unnatural, right? It can still send signals to the heart and will decrease the heart rate. And if that manipulation is enough, it can even stop the heart. So what would you think of your patients then? If you're working on somebody's neck, which is where you find the vagus nerve, and you stimulate it by accident, what's going to happen? Well, you could kill that person, right? So it's really important to know about all these different nerves. Okay, so here's the exam figure. Here's the list. Here's the function and the names. And the thing about these cranial nerves is that sometimes they are afferent nerves. What is an afferent nerve? What does an afferent nerve do? Okay, what's another name for afferent? We'll take it a step at a time. Another name for afferent is sensory. So which way are signals going for an afferent nerve? From PNS to CNS or CNS to PNS? From PNS to CNS, right? It's going to be receiving information from the periphery, bringing it in, right? So we're going to call that a sensory neuron. And some cranial nerves are purely motor, which is what? Another name for motor is efferent, right? For instance, this vagus nerve is efferent because it's sending signals to the heart to decrease heart rate, right? So that nerve is motor. And then some cranial nerves are a mix of both sensory and motor function, which is pretty strange because when we look at dorsal roots, what can you tell me about dorsal roots in terms of their function? This is a review from central nervous system. Remember a spinal root? Okay, what can you tell me about their function? How many roots do you have? You have two, right? You got dorsal and ventral. And what can you tell me about the dorsal root in terms of its function? Dorsal, there's an S in dorsal, right? And you have ventral, there's a T in ventral. That's how I kind of remember it, right? Even if I'm half asleep, I can figure it out. So the dorsal root is 100% sensory. The ventral root is 100% motor. It is never mixed. These spinal roots are never mixed, but some cranial nerves are mixed. Right, they both have efferent and afferent properties. All right, and we would like to know which one is which. And again, it might be a little bit complicated because I only give you one function, right? And so if it's mixed, you got to know a couple different functions. And that's more than I would ask you to do, but I do want you to know cranial nerves as to whether they are afferent, efferent, or mixed, right? That's the three ways that a nerve can be characterized. Either sensory or motor or both, which is mixed. So here is another mnemonic, right? So we're going to put a bunch of words together, and since we have 12 cranial nerves, there should be 12 words, right, in this mnemonic. And in this particular case, it's not the name of the cranial nerve, but it's the function of the cranial nerve, and this is how we're going to set up the mnemonic. S is going to stand for sensory. So we're going to pick a word that has an S at the very first letter of that word for sensory, right? We're going to say M is for motor. So we're going to think of a word that begins with an M if we know that that nerve is 100% motor. And if there's a cranial nerve that has both sensory and motor function, we're going to put a B. So we got to pick a word that has a B is the first letter, right? So here is the sentence that most people use to remember the function of cranial nerves as to whether they are sensory or motor or mixed. So here's the sentence. Some say money matters, but my brother says big bucks matter most. All right, so remember that one. And this. So what's the function of cranial nerve number one? Sensory. What's the function of cranial nerve number two? And you know what? It's purely sensory, 100% sensory, okay? And what about money? This cranial nerve number three is 100% efferent, right, or motor. And as a matter of fact, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What about cranial nerve number five? What is its function? It is both afferent and efferent, right? Okay, so here is another really handy mnemonic to where you don't just have to spend like the next 5 years memorizing everything, right? Because it's really easy to forget. So utilize these mnemonics to help you out. All right, so those are cranial nerves. And I think that's really all I wanted to. So here's a table that shows some of the functions, and it's a little bit more complicated. Just use your lecture notes right here and your study guide to really appreciate, narrow it down as to what you have to know. Okay, some of these other more esoteric functions of cranial nerves you'll pick up as we go through the rest of the class when we study the digestive system, endocrine system, etc. All right, so peripheral nervous system has two kinds of nerves, cranial nerves, and the second kind are spinal nerves. Cranial nerves originate from the brain. Spinal nerves originate from the, what's the other part of the central nervous system? Spinal cord, right? So that's a spinal nerve. Slide on the right shows the spinal cord. I don't see the vertebral column. All the bones have been taken away. But I can see the spinal cord, and I can see some projections coming out of the spinal cord. And these are the peripheral nerves. These are the spinal nerves. And I think I told you that there are 31 pairs of these. And none of them really have names, right? But they do have a designation by what level of the vertebral column they exit, like for instance, cervical, thoracic, lumbar. And then from superior to inferior, they are given numbers, pretty much like the names of vertebrae are as well. Okay, so spinal nerve number one comes out between the occipital bone and the atlas, or C1. Right, so that's how we start counting, from the very top of C1, right? And then between C1 and C2 is spinal nerve number two, right? C2 on down the line. Okay, so those are spinal nerves. And spinal nerves are a combination of both ventral and dorsal roots, right? So here is the dorsal root, here's the ventral root. They join together to form a spinal nerve, which I see right here exiting, right? And if the dorsal root is 100% sensory and the ventral root is 100% motor, what could you tell me about the function of this spinal nerve? It is? Yeah, it's mixed, right? All spinal nerves are mixed. Not all cranial nerves are, but all spinal nerves are. Okay, let's go to, this is a really good picture. All right, I think we've looked at this before, but it shows us all of the other detail that we want to know about. So here is the spinal cord. Here are nerves entering, right? That's the dorsal part. Here are nerves that are carrying signals out. That's the ventral root. All of these little things right here are called rootlets. They join together to form a root. Remember, this is just a single function, and down over here, this is motor. And here's the dorsal root ganglia. In the dorsal root, that has all the cell bodies of those unipolar neurons that are bringing information into the central nervous system. And remember, a unipolar neuron is always going to be a sensory neuron, and this is where you find it. And here is that ganglia. And a ganglion is a group of nerve cell bodies someplace in the peripheral nervous system. So that's why we see this little bump right here, and that's why we call it a ganglion, because it's just loaded with nerve cell bodies. All right, so when dorsal root, ventral root join together, here is a spinal nerve. Function is mixed, and some of these nerve signals have to go to areas of your body that are posterior to the vertebral column, and so they go this way. This thing right here is called the dorsal ramus, because it's going posterior, dorsal ramus. This one over here that's going to all the areas of your body in front or anterior to the vertebral column, this is what we call the ventral ramus. And remember, a ramus is just something that makes a 90 degree bend compared to the place that it originates from. So you're familiar with that. And when you look at this, probably you can appreciate that the ventral ramus is larger than the dorsal ramus. And that's because you just don't have a lot of body, right, posterior to the vertebral column. You got some muscles back there, some integument. That's about it. Most of your body is what? Anterior to the vertebral column. So that nerve, the ventral ramus, is a lot bigger and thicker because it has a lot more nerve fibers going through it. That's all there's to it. Okay, so these are the rootlets. Here are the roots. Here are the rami. Here's the spinal nerve. And I'm going to give you a little foreshadowing of the autonomic nervous system. Okay, autonomic nervous system is part of the peripheral nervous system, but very special. I see some nerves that run up and down on either side of the vertebral column. And these things kind of remind me of spinal cords, right? Because the spinal cord runs superior, inferior, or up and down through the vertebral column. Here are some other nerve pathways that kind of are parallel to the spinal cord, but outside the vertebral column. These have to do with a special nervous system called the sympathetic nervous system. And they form a big line or a chain, right, of these accumulations or groups of nerve cell bodies. Right, so what would we call this group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? Yeah, here's a dorsal root ganglia. This thing looks pretty much like this one over here, right? So here is a ganglion, but it's not dorsal root ganglion. This is what we call the sympathetic chain ganglion, or sympathetic chain ganglia. Chain because they're all linked together on these things that almost look like auxiliary spinal cords to me on either side of the vertebral column. So signals enter the sympathetic chain from a spinal nerve, and it enters through these rami communicantes. And there's two of them. There's a way a signal can get in, there's a way a signal can get out, rejoin the spinal nerve, and then follow that nerve to whatever organ it's going through. All right, so right now I just want you to know that these things on either side of the vertebral column are what we call the sympathetic chain ganglia, and sometimes they're called the sympathetic trunk ganglia, and they're all linked together. One is a ganglion. Okay, we're going to know the names of these two other little communicantes in the next chapter. So what else do I want you to know? So here's a good figure that shows the sympathetic chain ganglia, both roots, the spinal nerve, both rami. That's a good illustration to look at. Okay, let's start with this figure right here. All right, so here I see a bunch of spinal nerves going out to the periphery. And so here's C1, right, C2, all the way down here. When these spinal nerves get out into the periphery, sometimes they make this nice mess right here. You see this mess of interconnecting nerves? And there's one over here, one down over here, one over here. This is a plexus, a nerve plexus. And there's a cervical nerve plexus, there's a brachial nerve plexus, there's a lumbar nerve plexus, and there is a sacral nerve plexus, only four, right? And they originate from those different regions of the vertebral column or spinal cord. All right, so you say, well, gee whiz, why is this big mess of neurons right here? There's got to be a good reason. All right, so let's go to the next figure, right? So this is all four. I'm going to zoom in to one of these. And what picture do I have? I've got the cervical region right here. All right, so here is C1, right? This is the ventral ramus from the spinal nerve that leaves between the occipital bone and the atlas. It comes out, right? And then here's C2, C3, C4, C5. And that's all we have on this illustration. And we can see that there is a network and an interconnection of these different nerves. All of these little pieces right here have names, have special names with special nomenclature, but we're not going to get into that in this class. I hope you're not too disappointed with that. But if you want to stay after class, I can tell you how to name all these different things. But what I do want you to appreciate is why this mess is here. All right. And think about how you got to school today, or how maybe you got to work later today. How did you get to school today? You probably have a favorite route that's pretty fast, right? Maybe you hop on the 405 and then get on the 605, come north, get off at Carson Street, drive here. But as you're driving to school, you might listen to the radio to see if there is an accident on one of the freeways, like the 605, and traffic isn't moving. So would you choose to get on the 605 if it is just a parking lot? I would say no, because then you wouldn't get to school, right? If there's an accident on a freeway you want to take and you can't use it because it's all blocked, what would you do if you knew that ahead of time? Yeah, you would take an alternate route to your destination so that you could get there, right? Okay, so there's more than one way you could get from your house to school, your house to work, right, based on how the availability of those roads are. And that is one of the purposes of this nerve plexus. The nerve plexus is there so that if there's damage to one nerve, there still can be nerve impulses that can get to a very important organ through a different route. Okay, so here is a nerve that I want you to know, a peripheral nerve. This is the phrenic nerve. Here's a phrenic nerve. It goes all the way down to the diaphragm. Even though it originates in the neck or cervical region, it goes all the way down to the diaphragm. What can you tell me about the diaphragm? I think maybe you know where it is because we studied muscles. I'm not sure you really know what the function is, but we looked at actions of some muscles, a lot of muscles in lab. Does anybody know what the action or the function of the diaphragm? You know where the diaphragm is, right? Between thoracic cavity and abdominal cavity. At rest, it's kind of dome-shaped. When it contracts, it gets flat and it moves inferiorly. What happens then when that diaphragm contracts? Yes, it allows you to inspire air, which is good. Breathing is good. Breathing is wonderful, right? Because that's what brings oxygen into our bodies. Those mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. And if those mitochondria can't make ATP, your brain is going to go dormant in 2 seconds. Your brain is going to die in 2 minutes, right? So that's how important that oxygen is. And that all relies on this phrenic nerve to excite the diaphragm. All right, so if there is damage to some part of the cervical region, then, right, there might not be impulses, nerve impulses going to the diaphragm. You can't breathe by yourself. And hopefully you're lucky, because if that happens to you, hopefully you'll be around like some people in this class. What do some people in this class have the ability to do? They can actually breathe for somebody when they can't breathe for themselves. What do we call that technique? Yeah, that's CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, right? And that's what happened to that actor, Christopher Reeve, fell off a horse, broke his neck, right? Destroyed this phrenic nerve, couldn't breathe for himself, but fortunately he was riding with people that knew CPR and saved his life until he got to a hospital and they put him on a respirator. Okay, and then he lived for a longer period of time. But he would only have lived for 2 minutes without that help. So this phrenic nerve is so important because it keeps you alive, because you can breathe. Well, where do signals come from that join the phrenic nerve? I can see signals coming from C5, right? I can see signals coming from C4, and I can see signals coming from C3. Each of those spinal nerves contribute to neurons that go through the phrenic nerve. All right, so here is I want you to know what the origin of the phrenic nerve is, and there's a funny, nice little saying that you can remember that will help you remember what the origin of the phrenic nerve is. And are you ready to hear that saying that's kind of fun? That's really important to know. The saying is C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive because that's what gets signals to the phrenic nerve. All right, so the beauty of this nerve plexus is, right, if there is damage between C4 and C5, that's going to destroy it's going to prevent information getting into the phrenic nerve from C5, but that's not such a catastrophic injury because the phrenic nerve can also receive signals from C3 and C4, which are not damaged. Right, so the nerve plexus just allows alternate routes for important nerve impulses to get to an essential organ in your body, like the diaphragm and many other kinds of organs. All right, so the cervical plexus is in the neck. Where do we find the brachial plexus? Okay, it's not really in the arm, it's more in the axillary region and shoulder region, but here is the brachial plexus. And I don't want you to know much about that, but I do want you to know where it is located and what the function, what's the function of this brachial plexus? What's the beauty of this brachial plexus? It's there so that important nerve impulses can take alternate routes to get to important organs. All right, so a nerve plexus is great because it can sustain a lot of damage without cessation of function. That is really something nice. Right? Usually when something gets damaged, the function changes, but this nerve plexus gives you a little backup system. All right, so here is the brachial plexus once again. And we got two more plexes. Oh, look at all this fun stuff we're not gonna get to talk about. Okay, here is another nerve plexus. This is the lumbar plexus, right? L1 through L5, and maybe even part of S1 down over here, but L1 through L5 is a good way to locate that. there is an important nerve that originates from the lumbar plexus. And just like the phrenic nerve, I do want you to know this one. The femoral nerve originates from the lumbar plexus. And I see it right here. All right, it's a big important nerve. And that's going to help you find that nerve in lab when we start to look at nerves, right? So phrenic nerve comes from cervical plexus. Femoral nerve comes from lumbar plexus. And then there's one last nerve that you all have heard about that I want you to know something about, and that is the sciatic nerve. Has anybody ever heard of sciatic nerve? Probably, right? Because when it's impinged in certain parts, maybe it's impinged in the interventricular foramen or if passing by some muscles in your body, right, it produces a condition called sciatica, and that can be an extremely painful condition when that nerve gets damaged, or it might even prevent motion. It might have an afferent or an efferent effect when the sciatic nerve gets damaged. So this, what's the origin? What plexus contributes to the sciatic nerve? It is the sacral plexus. What about the femoral nerve? It is the lumbar plexus, and the phrenic nerve comes from the cervical plexus, right? So that's really what I want you to know. All right, well, somewhere early in class, we talked about motions in your body like flexion, extension, right? Adduction, abduction, and also at your ankle, right? And what are the motions at your ankle? Pointing your toes into the ground or lifting your body up is plantar flexion. Lifting your toes off the ground is dorsiflexion. And we said how important it is to make sure all your patients can dorsiflex properly, because that prevents them from tripping on the ground and breaking their neck or their femur or something really dangerous. All right, so dorsiflexion is important. Now why, and I said back then that when somebody can't dorsiflex, that could be an indication of spinal cord injury or vertebral column injury, like maybe a ruptured intervertebral disc. So why would an injury in somebody's back affect how their toes move or how their ankle moves, right? Well, one way to appreciate that is to know something about a dermatome. So let's see, where the heck is a dermatome? Dermatome. Ah, right here. All right, so here is a dermatome. And this is just a map of the surface of your body and where sensation or motor control comes from in terms of what level of the spinal cord. All right, so all the way from the shoulder down to this anterior part of the arm and forearm, this part of your arm gets nerve impulses from C5. Right. But a little bit more medial, and it runs along this line right here, this gets nerve impulses from T1. So this area right here shows you what nerve, in terms of the spinal cord, contributes to both motor and sensory function in this part of your body. So if you poke somebody with a pin in this area and they can't feel it, right, even though this is way down in your forearm, that you might want to start investigating nerves that are leaving around C5. So you don't have to image the whole vertebral column and brain. You can just look at that specific area. All right, now what about motor for the ankle? All right, L4, L5 pretty much covers that whole area. So if you have a sensory deficit or motor deficit, right, and these muscles up over here that cause dorsiflexion, a good place to start to look, or one place you want to start looking, is what? At L4 and L5 to see if there's some kind of nerve compression. And that's lumbar. What nerve did we say comes from the lumbar plexus? Lumbar plexus. Okay. You got what? Phrenic, you got femoral, you got sciatic. Okay, femoral. That's right. So by knowing now some of that anatomy, right, there's deficits in this region producing a deficit in dorsiflexion, plantar flexion, okay, you might want to start looking at the femoral nerve, do some nerve conduction studies, or look at that intervertebral foramen where these nerves actually leave the vertebral column. All right, so all of this stuff is really handy. So here is a dermatome on the anterior, here's a dermatome on the posterior side of the body. Sometimes it's really straightforward, just transverse sections, but sometimes it's a little bit more complicated. It all depends on where those spinal nerves go. Okay, so that is the last topic in peripheral nervous system. Last topic in peripheral nervous system. Who's got a question? Do you love mnemonics? Yeah, you should, right? Okay. All right, so I'm gonna put this away. And then, what is next? Peripheral, autonomic nervous system. Okay, I'm recording lecture with a recorder that I usually don't use because I left the one that I usually use at home, unfortunately. And I have trouble getting the lecture off of this particular recorder because they don't make drivers for this MP3 player anymore. It only works on Windows Millennium or maybe 2000, and probably not many people have even heard of Millennium operating system or Windows 2000. So I don't have any of those computers around. I have one that sort of works, and if I can get this lecture off with that one computer, I'll be happy to put it online. But if I can't get it off, you should go to a previous semester if you want to hear this lecture, right? And I don't know, I probably have 10 years of lectures recorded online. So you can take your pick whatever year you want to listen to. And the lecture is similar, but it won't be as good as the one today, because the more times you do something, the better you get at it, right? That's just the way it is. All right, but they're almost as good. So go back if I can't get it online for you. All right, so let's look at the autonomic nervous system. So this peripheral, I'm going to put that away. Okay, we're good here. Let's pull some pictures up. Here's autonomic nervous system. Okay, and let's start with, do I like that figure? I like that pretty much. All right, so here is a figure, basically what I've given you during the nervous system introductory lecture notes, with just that organization with arrows going to various places, just a concept map of the whole nervous system, like central, peripheral, and peripheral you can break down into motor and sensory and somatic versus autonomic. This is the same diagram, but it just maybe looks a little bit more complicated. Oh, let me go back. So what we're gonna look at, right, we're gonna look at part of the motor nervous system, which is part of the peripheral. Motor you can break down into somatic, which goes to skeletal muscle, not part of the autonomic. So somatic versus autonomic nervous system. Remember, somatic goes to effector organs that you have voluntary control of, like skeletal muscle. Autonomic nervous system, right, goes to other effector organs. So let's make a list of the other effector organs. Somatic covers skeletal effector organs, skeletal muscle effector organs. What about the autonomic nervous system? What effector organs are included there? Okay, I heard smooth muscle, I love it. Cardiac muscle, love that. And glands. And you know what? That's everything. So you got three kinds of effector organs that are controlled by the autonomic nervous system: smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. And unlike the skeletal muscular system, which is based on antagonism, right? You got biceps and triceps. You don't have two hearts. You only have one heart. And so you need two different nervous systems, one to accelerate the heart and one to slow the heart down. And that's why there is a sympathetic division and parasympathetic division. All right, so you got two divisions of the autonomic nervous system, and now you should be able to tell me what's the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic. They are antagonistic to each other, right? And remember, that's not a futile, useless thing. That's really important to have, just like the gas pedal and brake pedal in your car, right? Okay, so sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system. Here is a pretty important exam figure, but I think I put in a little modified version in your study guide that's not so artsy. It's a little bit more straightforward, but it contains the same information. So you should use this diagram to fill in the information in the study guide. All right, so let's go over this. When you look at this figure right here, all right, first we can break the peripheral nervous system down into somatic versus autonomic. Right? Somatic goes to, look over here, skeletal muscle. Right? The autonomic nervous system goes to where? What are the effector organs for autonomic nervous system? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and then here are some glands. Right? These are the three types of effector organs. So, I don't know, you should be impressed with this figure. It's pretty cool. It's a nice illustration. All right, so let's start with the somatic nervous system. The cell bodies, right? Cell bodies are in the spinal cord. And starting from the spinal cord, does it say spinal cord any here with this particular color? I don't see it. But this is going to be in a gray horn of some kind of the spinal cord, right? Because nerve cell bodies and dendrites are gray, produce a gray color. So the cell body is in the central nervous system. And how many nerve fibers does it take to get from the central nervous system all the way out to the periphery to this skeletal muscle? How many nerves do you see? I see a cell body, an axon, end of an axon. Do you see another cell body after that? I do not. Right? So somatic motor is due to one neuron going all the way from the CNS to that effector organ. So somatic motor neurons are just, they're just singular, right? You don't need more than that. And the neurotransmitter, right, released by this particular neuron is acetylcholine. And I see acetylcholine has a shape kind of like a triangle. I'll make some sense of that in just a second. And when acetylcholine binds to receptors in skeletal muscles within the neuromuscular junction, what's the response that that skeletal muscle produces? It says right here in the very last column. What's the response? It says effect right here, effect and response. I think we can consider it to be the same thing. Acetylcholine binds to receptors on skeletal muscle. What happens to skeletal muscle? It is excited, right? It contracts. That's the only thing that can happen to skeletal muscle when it receives information from a neuron. Right, so that means, that's another way of saying that skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. When it receives a nerve signal via acetylcholine, what is its only choice? It has no choice. What does it do? It contracts. That's the only thing that can happen. So if I tell a skeletal muscle to reach out, grab this cup of coffee so that I can have a sip of coffee, oh, I got to open up the coffee container first. Right, open it up, take a sip. Oh, that's good, thank God. Okay, so I tell my body to go get a cup of coffee. Can those skeletal muscles ever say, no, you don't need a cup of coffee? No, you don't need that extra glass of wine. No, you don't need all that sugar. Can a skeletal muscle ever say that? No, it just obeys your commands, right? So it is always excitatory. Acetylcholine on skeletal muscle is always excitatory. So that's the basis of how we're going to compare the somatic nervous system with autonomic nervous system. All right, so and how many divisions are there in the autonomic nervous system? Somatic only has one. Autonomic has two, sympathetic and parasympathetic. All right, and the nerve cell bodies are in the central nervous system someplace. Oh, here it says central nervous system. Yeah, central nervous system. And let's count. How many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to an effector organ? What are the effector organs? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, or gland. How many neurons does it take? I see a cell body, but it doesn't go all the way. It stops. And then here's another cell body. And here is a second neuron going the rest of the way to the effector organ. And here is that structural functional unit of communication between cells, which is called a synapse, right? And here is the chemical messenger that goes across the synapse, and in this particular case it's acetylcholine as well, right? So that's the neurotransmitter released by this first cell. That excites the second cell, nerve impulses come down to the end of the second cell, and then the second cell releases a neurotransmitter which is different than acetylcholine. It is norepinephrine. Okay, so the neurotransmitters are different. Now, what nervous system, what part of the autonomic nervous system are we looking at? Sympathetic or parasympathetic? Yeah, so what I would like you to link up, norepinephrine is the neurotransmitter that's used by the sympathetic nervous system, okay? All right, I'll get into some of these other details in a second. Let's compare that with parasympathetic nervous system. What's a similarity compared to sympathetic? How is parasympathetic and sympathetic similar in its anatomy? How many neurons does it take to get from CNS to cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, or glands? One and two, right? And here's another similarity. What's the neurotransmitter between the first and second cell? Acetylcholine, right? Acetylcholine is used in both of these places But now here is a difference. There's a couple of differences you should be aware of. What is the neurotransmitter that's released by the second neuron of the parasympathetic pathway? It's not norepinephrine, it is acetylcholine. All right, so there are different neurotransmitters which can produce different effects in the body. So if we look at the effect on these various effector organs on the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, sometimes it can be excitatory or sometimes it can be inhibitory, right? Because these things are antagonistic to each other. So these organs can make up their mind. They can decide what to do based on the needs of your body, right? So if you're sleeping, what is your heart going to decide to do? Slow down, right? It's not going to decide to stop, but it will slow down. And then when you start to exercise, what's going to happen to the heart? It can decide to speed up, right? And that's because it's getting information from both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, so here we have a group of nerve cell bodies, right? Right here, group of nerve cell bodies. And what part of the nervous system do we have these group of nerve cell bodies? I got it right here. What's that? Peripheral nervous system. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? A ganglion. So here is, all right, a sympathetic ganglion. Kind of looked at that a little bit, the sympathetic chain ganglia, those little bulges. Right, so here is a chain ganglia or a sympathetic ganglion. Here's a parasympathetic ganglion, group of nerve cell bodies. Right, so the first cell in this two-cell pathway, this two-neuron pathway, the first one right here is called the preganglionic nerve fiber. Preganglionic because it comes before the ganglion. And then the second neuron is called the postganglionic fiber, right? And the same thing for the parasympathetic nervous system. There's a preganglionic fiber and a postganglionic fiber. And this is hugely important because, right, the preganglionic and postganglionic fibers secrete different neurotransmitters, and people have different ways of manipulating your autonomic nervous system to help control things that need control, like high blood pressure, for instance. Right? So it's important to know about these neurotransmitters. Okay, here is another similarity. The preganglionic fiber. Do I have the cursor on the preganglionic fiber? Yes, of the sympathetic nervous system. Can you see that it is myelinated? I see some Schwann cells right here. The somatic neuron is heavily myelinated. It's easy to see, but can you get an impression that there is myelination on the preganglionic fiber, right? And same thing for the preganglionic fiber for the parasympathetic nervous system. In contrast, what about the postganglionic fiber? Non-myelinated. Same thing for parasympathetic nervous system, right? So all the neurons in the autonomic nervous system, if they are postganglionic, are non-myelinated. They're slow, right, in conducting impulses. But the preganglionic fibers are fast because they are myelinated. So this is really a wonderful slide that shows all this kind of stuff. Okay, so how do the heart and smooth muscle and glands know what neurotransmitter is floating around them? And the neurotransmitters, the way that receptors work is by the anatomy of that particular chemical. And what does anatomy mean? What does anatomy mean? The structure. Yeah, just the structure, the form of that particular chemical. And that's why norepinephrine is drawn here as a circle. And that's why acetylcholine here is drawn as a triangle. That just signifies that these two different neurotransmitters have a different shape, and hence they will have a different function in your body, right? And of course, norepinephrine is not circular, acetylcholine is not triangular, but this just shows you that it is what? They're different from each other, and that's what makes the difference in shape, makes the difference in function in these effector organs. All right, so that's a nice comparison. There's only one other little complicating factor, okay? And it's complicated because of this. Our understanding is that somatic motor outflow or somatic motor path requires one neuron, right? An outflow pathway for an autonomic signal has two neurons, right? Both sympathetic and parasympathetic, right? That's the outflow pathway has two neurons. Here is a special case of a sympathetic outflow pathway that only has one neuron. Here is a neuron that goes out of the central nervous system to the adrenal gland, and in particular, the adrenal medulla. So what part of the adrenal gland is the adrenal medulla, superficial or deep? It's the deep part, okay? So this nerve goes all the way into the deep part of the adrenal medulla, right? And what does the preganglionic sympathetic fiber release in terms of neurotransmitter? Okay, what is the neurotransmitter that's released by the sympathetic preganglionic fiber? It's really wordy, but I want you to hear that, because once you get it down, it won't be too bad, right? The preganglionic fiber for sympathetic outflow is acetylcholine, right? So here is that nerve fiber that enters the adrenal medulla, releases acetylcholine like all of the other preganglionic fibers. There are no neurons in the adrenal medulla, but there are some cells that are modified. They are almost like neurons. When they're stimulated by acetylcholine, they release norepinephrine into the extracellular space, which is picked up by the blood, this particular blood vessel, and then where does that norepinephrine go? Wherever blood goes, right? It goes everywhere in your body, right? And so that carries that sympathetic signal everywhere in your body. So you don't have to have every organ innervated by a sympathetic neuron, because it's going to receive that sympathetic signal from the adrenal medulla. So the cells of the adrenal medulla, sometimes we call these chromaffin cells, are acting like one of the neurons on a sympathetic outflow pathway. The cells of the adrenal medulla that release norepinephrine are acting like what cell that we've been looking at so far? They're acting like the postganglionic fiber in the usual outflow pathway. All right. And what do we call a compound that's released by a gland, picked up by the blood, travels to a different location, binds to receptor, changes the response of that target tissue? What do we call that compound that gets picked up by the blood? I mentioned it, but it's been a while. It's called a hormone. So in this particular case, right, we have both epinephrine and norepinephrine acting like a hormone. So that's kind of confusing. If somebody asks you, is norepinephrine a neurotransmitter that I see here, or is norepinephrine a hormone like we see right here, what are you going to say? A little confusing. Yeah, it has the abilities of both. And when there are compounds that have that ability, we don't want to just say hormone or neurotransmitter. We might want to say neurohormone, right? And so here is a really important junction between the nervous system and your endocrine system. There are a number of places in your body where you can't really separate the nervous system from the endocrine system, and here is just one example of that. And as a matter of fact, in a lot of classes, you don't separate the nervous system from the endocrine system. You study both together, right? So you don't study the nervous system and then the endocrine system. You have a chapter in your book that's called the neuroendocrine system, because these are things that help control things in your body. But remember, nervous system has very fast onset but short duration. Hormones have, it takes longer for them to have an effect, right? So their onset is longer, but their duration is longer as well, right? So both of these systems are complementary to each other. One is fast but short-lived, the other is slow but long-lived. Both are necessary in your body. All right, so, wow, I almost talked the whole time on this slide. That's how important this slide is. So maybe even in lab, we'll take a look at that. But there's still some other details on this slide that are important. Here is the parasympathetic neuron, and indeed, it takes two neurons to get to some effector organ. Make sure you know that what neurotransmitter is released by the preganglionic fiber and postganglionic fiber for the parasympathetic nervous system. And it is acetylcholine in both cases, right? So you have to know that level of knowledge with the autonomic nervous system. Okay, but when I look at the axon terminus for the parasympathetic nervous system, do you see one, or do you see bifurcation, trifurcation? Do you see many branches at the axon terminus for the parasympathetic nervous system? Do you see one ending or many? I see one. What about the sympathetic nervous system? Do you see one nerve ending or many. You see many, right? So that is another important distinction. Parasympathetic outflow is very discrete. It goes to one organ at a time. It can go to the heart without affecting other organs inside your body, right? But sympathetic outflow is much more broad-based. It's not discrete, right? It's indiscriminate. When there are sympathetic signals in your body, they go everywhere. It activates the whole sympathetic nervous system, right? And that concept is backed up because when the adrenal medulla releases norepinephrine, where does it go? Not to just one place in your body, it goes everywhere, right? So the sympathetic nervous system, when it becomes activated, activates your whole body. But when the parasympathetic nervous system gets activated, it's very discrete. It only goes to one place. Maybe your eye, maybe your heart, maybe your digestive system, right? But sympathetic all over at the same time. All right, so you're gonna, I think in the pre-lecture reading guide, it asks you to compare and contrast, right? And then the answer key for that pre-lecture reading assignment is going to become available pretty soon, probably after lecture today. Did anybody do that pre-lecture reading assignment? I hope so, because this is a really complicated lecture if this is all brand new material to you, okay? But hopefully you'll be able to listen to it again online. All right, so here's a pretty good question. What's the effector in the somatic voluntary pathway? What's the effector organ? Somatic is? Skeletal muscle, says right here. What are the effectors in the autonomic or visceral motor pathway? Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, glands, right? Okay. Control architecture. The autonomic nervous system is based on antagonism, right? Which is really handy, right? So you have antagonistic control where you have two inputs. Tonic control is only if you have one. And antagonistic control, I just think of another plumbing example. Maybe you would like to have water at a particular temperature when you open up your faucet at home. What do you need to get water at a particular temperature, your desired temperature? Should you just have a cold water faucet? Should you just have a hot water faucet? You should have both. And what do? You mix those two together to get the precise temperature that you want, right? Okay, so that's the beauty of antagonistic control. What time we got? Okay, I can still talk a little bit. All right, the two antagonistic divisions of the autonomic nervous system, we got what? Parasympathetic and sympathetic. And we've been discussing some of the anatomy of that. The cell bodies of the parasympathetic nervous system are in the brain stem. Okay, so it comes from cranial nerves, parasympathetic, and in particular, cranial nerve number 10. Who can remember what cranial nerve number 10 was? I heard it, vagus nerve, wonderful, right? Cranial nerve number 1, very important parasympathetic neuron. All right, so if we look at the slide on the right, we see that parasympathetic signals or outflow can come out of the brain, right? And number 10 is like the most important one, or it can leave the central nervous system at S2, S3, and S4, but nowhere in between. That's kind of strange, but that's just the way it is. I don't want to talk about the evolution of why that happened. All right. So sometimes we say parasympathetic outflow is craniosacral outflow. Parasympathetic is craniosacral, and we're going to look at this a little bit probably next time. And craniosacral outflow ganglia. All right, so here is the preganglionic fiber leaving, like the vagus nerve right here. Here is the presympathetic fiber. It goes all the way to the heart. So it's very long. And then the postganglionic fiber is on the surface of the heart or even inside the heart. So the length of the postganglionic fiber for parasympathetic nervous system is small. It's dinky. It's minuscule. It's microscopic. But the length of the preganglionic is very long. What are the target organs? Many, many target organs, but here are four that I want you to know, right? So I've simplified a huge list down to some really nice things that are simple. All right, so parasympathetic nervous system, what's the effect on the heart? Effect on the heart. Oh, who's still awake? What's the effect? It decreases heart rate. What's the effect on the digestive system? It speeds up digestive processes in terms of motility and secretion of enzymes and secretion of other kinds of substances. It is excitatory. So inhibitory on the heart, excitatory on digestion. What about respiration? Inhibitory on respiration. And it also causes pupil constriction. Your pupil is what that little, it's controlled by the iris, so that can constrict and dilate, adjust the amount of light that enters your eye. All right, so here we see parasympathetic nervous outflow can either be inhibitory or excitatory. And I'll give you a hint on how you can figure this out in just a little bit. But what's most important, so you can't just tell. You can't say that parasympathetic nervous system is always inhibitory, because sometimes it is excitatory, right? But what can you say? If you know that the parasympathetic nervous system is inhibitory on the heart, what can you tell me about the sympathetic nervous system? On the heart, the sympathetic nervous system has to be excitatory, right? It's got to be the opposite. If you know that the parasympathetic nervous system is excitatory on your digestive system, what can you tell me about the sympathetic effects on your digestive system? They are going to be opposite or inhibitory, right? And these two effects are mixed together, just like hot water, cold water in your faucet, to give precise control and balance over your heart rate, your digestion, respiration, pupil dilation, okay? So that's the only thing you can say for sure. And how are you going to remember the difference between parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system? And we characterize these two nervous systems. First, the parasympathetic. We like to call it the rest and digest nervous system. When you're resting and you're digesting something, that's when the parasympathetic nervous system becomes activated, right? Because parasympathetic nervous system excites your digestive properties. And when you're resting, what is your heart rate? It goes down, right? So rest and digest is a good way to characterize parasympathetic. The best way to characterize the sympathetic nervous system is fight and flight, which is when you're presented with a life-threatening circumstance, what should happen to your heart rate? Increase, right? What about your digestive processes? Not so immediately important, right? So your digestive system is going to shut down. What about respiration when you're presented with, we ever scared to death on the freeway and you think you're going to get run over by a big truck, right? You gasp and then you start breathing really heavy and your heart starts to rate increases. And actually the force of contraction, sometimes your heart just feels like it's going to jump out of your chest when you're sure, for sure you're going to die, right? Hopefully that's never happened to you. And what about when you're presented with a really scary situation? What about pupil diameter? Should it dilate to let a lot of light in so that you can see what's going on? Or should it constrict, right, to protect your eye? It should dilate so that you can see better, right? That's all an effect of the sympathetic nervous system. So those are four things that I do want you to know. Not everything in your book, but these four things. And you only have to memorize one, because what do you know about the other? It's going to be opposite because of that antagonistic relationship. Okay, we're not quite done. We're almost done. All right, so let's pretend something. Let's pretend that after anatomy today, you're going to go to work. And I have no idea how you guys take anatomy class and go to work at the same time during the summer. But let's just say you have a job. And what is your job? Maybe you work at a grocery store, okay, or a convenience store, or maybe a place that rents videos. Do they have those stores anymore? You can go in and rent DVDs or anything like that. Okay, well, let's just say you do, okay? You work in some kind of small store, and you're the only person that works there, especially at night, and it just so happens that you don't have many customers. You're in there you're renting DVDs or VHS tapes, and you're in that store ready to rent these tapes out, and do you have many customers? You do not, right? So what do you do, okay, when you're at work? Well, you're getting paid to be there. Is that a good thing? Getting paid to show up there? Oh yeah, that's the whole reason why you go, right? So you feel good because you're getting paid, and are you working really hard? No, you're kind of relaxed. You don't have a lot to do. So what do you do with that time? Be really bored? You probably open up your anatomy book, go to autonomic nervous system, start answering some of those questions, review things, and the autonomic nervous system starts to make sense. So again, how are you feeling? You're getting paid, you're not working really hard, you're getting prepared for anatomy class. What is your feeling? Are you, you're accomplishing a lot, should be feeling good, right? And you're relatively rested when that happens. All right, so what is your heart rate then when everything is in control and things are even better than in control? You're getting paid, you're learning, you're accomplishing everything all at the same time. What is your heart rate? It should be reduced, right? Because your parasympathetic nervous system is being activated, right? Rest and digest. All right, time to close shop. And you didn't have any customers, so all the money in the cash register matches what you gave out. The receipts and debits all cancel out, so you didn't make like a $20 mistake, so you didn't have to take a $20 bill out of your wallet and put it in the cash register, right? So everything is nice and in order, and it's your job to lock up, and you're ready to go home. So how do you feel after you got paid to go to work? It was really, really easy. You did anatomy at the same time. You learned a lot. Ready to go home. It's always good to go home. What about your heart rate and how are you feeling now? You're feeling great. Good to go home, right? Heart rate decreased. Parasympathetic nervous system is activated. Okay, so you get your keys out. You walk to the front door. And all of a sudden, all the lights in the neighborhood go black. There's a power outage. All the lights in your shop go black. All the street lights are, nothing is happening there. You can't see anything, right? So now what happens to your heart rate? If all of a sudden, if I turned all the lights off here, fire alarm started going off, what happens to your heart rate? Starts to increase, all right? And so you turn around, can't see what you're doing, but you're able to lock the door. You walk into the parking lot and then realize that the parking lot was full when you got to work and you didn't park in the parking lot, you had to park two blocks away. All right, so now you got to walk out into the neighborhood that you're not really familiar with and it's completely dark. Now how are you feeling? How are you feeling, like kind of satisfied or a little anxious? A little anxious, right? Because you're by yourself, you're in the dark, you got to walk a long distance. All right, so what nervous system is becoming activated? The sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight nervous system, right? Increased heart rate. What else is happening? What about for your digestive system? Sympathetic system becomes activated, right? Digestive system starts to shut down. What about pupil dilation? Pupils dilate, right? And respirations start to increase, right? All right, so you start walking to your car. And again, you can't see anything, but kind of know where your car is. You almost get to your car, you walk about a block and a half, and then all of a sudden you hear behind you. What's that? Footsteps. You can't see who's there, you just hear these footsteps, and they're getting closer and closer and closer. All right, now what nervous system is really activated? Parasympathetic or sympathetic? Sympathetic nervous system. Right, your heart rate really increases, your respiration really increases, and you're kind of getting a little bit scared, right? That is a nice example of activation of the sympathetic nervous system, okay? But we're not quite done with the little meditation yet, right? The last thing is, all of a sudden somebody says, oh, what are you doing out here at night so late? And you recognize it was that actor that I had hired to do all those videos. You hear my voice asking you, what are you doing out here so late? Now what nervous system is becoming activated? The parasympathetic nervous system, because now everything is sort of making sense. You don't feel like you're in jeopardy. You hear a familiar voice, right? So you hear a friend's voice and now your heart rate starts to go down. So your sympathetic nervous system starts to cut back. Your parasympathetic nervous system takes over. So your heart rate slows down, respiration slows down. It's okay for your digestive system to come back, wakes up a little bit, okay? So that's a really good way to compare sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Parasympathetic, rest and digest. Sympathetic is fight and flight. And if you ever want to consider the effects of those two nervous systems on an effector organ, think of those two scenarios and it will pretty much fit in almost exactly to one of those scenarios. So it's not really too complicated. Okay, should I turn the lights on? Is anybody too scared to get up? I hope not, because you hear my voice, right? So everything's okay, and I'll see you up in lab. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. I know we went over just a little bit today, but hopefully it wasn't too bad. I'll try to get to the lecture online.